WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. After the rhythm of jazz turned to bebop, Arthur Taylor became one of the most in-demand drummers. He played on over 200 records, including now classic sessions with Charlie Parker, Thelonious Monk, Miles Davis, and John Coltrane. Now Taylor leads his own band, Taylor's Wailers. This is the title track of his recent album, Mr. A.T. Back in 1963, Arthur Taylor went to Europe and ended up staying for 17 years, 10 years in Paris, 7 in Belgium. While he lived abroad, he interviewed many of his fellow musicians as they toured Europe. He published many of those interviews in his book Notes and Tones. A new expanded edition has just been published by DeCapo Press. I asked Taylor how he ended up in Europe.
There was a man who owned a Blue Note who was trying to get me to come and play there for many years. And he had offered me this 3-month contract. So I said, great, okay, I'll go to Europe. I was going to play with people like Johnny Griffin and Kenny Drew, men who I'd worked with most of my life. And I said, fine. And I had known Paris and known France, and I liked Europe. So I took the 3-month contract, and then I stayed 6 months, and there was no reason to leave because I was very busy. I was having a good time. I was traveling around, you know.
Was there already a kind of thriving jazz scene in Paris when you got there of American jazz musicians?
Yes, it was great, too. It was very great. It was very healthy. And I guess Kenny Clarke, the great drummer, he was the oldest, most, so he was most respected. And he knew a lot of people in government and people in very high office, you know, and at that time, the movie stars used to come and hear us, you know, Van Damme and Brigitte Bardot, all those kind of people were interested in this type of music at that time.
Now, Kenny Clarke is one of the first great bebop drummers. So was he helpful to you when you got to Paris, or were you a bit of competition for him?
Well, Kenny had always tried to encourage me. He always wanted to encourage me to study. Because, as I said, I was self-trained, and he always tried to encourage me. So he said, "You can be better. You're going to be better, and you can make more money and everything. You'll be more versatile, and you'll expand as a musician." But I never bothered. And there were other musicians who said the same thing. But then, when I moved to Paris, when I was living in Paris, Kenny opened a school. Which was in Selma Saxophone Building in Paris. And he insisted that I come and study. And if I didn't go and study, I would have to fight with him. So I didn't want to have a physical fight with someone who I respected and loved so much. And I'm serious about that. He was that vehement about it.
Was it a school that he was teaching?
He was a teacher. There were two professors. He and another classical Italian man, Agostini, who was from Italy. They had the school. And it went great. People thought I was crazy, though. I started out with the kids the first time you pick up a drumstick.
Wow, really? Because, I mean, you'd already played with Bud Powell, Miles Davis, John Coltrane.
That's right.
Now you're back in school.
I had made 200 albums at the time.
Right, right. So what did you learn?
Huh?
What did you learn?
I found out what I was doing all these years.
Which was?
And I could refine it. And I could apply it technically.
So you felt you had more control?
More control, yes.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Well, how did it feel to be in classes with people who were picking up drumsticks for the first time?
It was interesting because you start at the basic. You start at the first thing you learn. I was in classes of maybe 8-10 kids from the age of like 10 to 16 or 17. First time they ever played. Some of them turned out to be nice drummers, too. That's the pleasure of seeing those things.
Now, how did you start playing drums?
Well, my family, everyone was, I was like, but I guess I was the slow one of the slowest one of the family, the least educated, the least everything in the whole family. And my sister was a psychologist and a classical pianist, and I didn't want to play piano. I didn't want to do anything, really. I just want to hang around with the guys or something. And my parents were always after me to study, and which I didn't want to do it. I never got along with the teachers, couldn't get along with anybody. So after I had an opportunity to have a career as an athlete, I was a pretty good athlete, which I'm finding out more and more now from some of my cousins and old friends, how good I really was as an athlete. And my father told me, he said, "You must be crazy. You know, how are you going to make a living being an athlete? You know, you can't play the professional sports and make any money doing that, you know." That's before Jackie Robinson and all that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So music was like a second choice. And I chose music because I don't like to get up in the morning. I like to be on my time. I like to sleep in my time and do it on my time and not be on somebody else's time all the time.
No, but there must have been a point where music started to become much more important to you.
I really mean that. That was the, I don't want to get up in the morning. I don't want to be moving when everybody else is moving. When everybody's going to work, I want to be sleeping. When they're sleeping, I want to be out having a good time.
But didn't music become more important to you than just that after a while?
It's a pleasure to play music. I couldn't ask for anything more. That's the for me, that's the greatest thing I've ever done in my life, to be able to play music. That is a thrill of a lifetime. It's a thrill every time, even to this day. I've been doing it so long. But I'm still very excited to play music. I love it. It's a release. You don't have to be bothered with the ordinary things of life and trivialities when you really get involved in music.
My guest is drummer Arthur Taylor. His book of interviews with jazz musicians, Notes and Tones, has just been published in a new edition. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with drummer Arthur Taylor. Now, in 1957, you performed on a really important jazz recording, the Miles Davis album, Miles Ahead.
Mm-hmm.
And this featured arrangements by Gil Evans.
Yeah.
What did the session mean to you at the time?
Oh, that was thrilling. That was really thrilling. Because at the time I was working with Miles' band, and we would finish working in the village and say 4, 3, 4, 5 o'clock in the morning, go to his apartment. And I would just sit there and have a drink and eat something, and I would watch he and Gil work on this music for the recordings session, which they'd spent months putting that together. And it was interesting to see people really work on something constructive, you know.
Mm-hmm. Let me play the beginning of the composition, Miles Ahead. Did Gil Evans arrange the drumming at all? Did he give you a sense of what he wanted on there?
Well, I'll tell you what, at the time, to be honest, I came in this, I didn't want to do the date. Miles had convinced me to do this record and to play with his band, and we were working in Central Park with Hank Jones and Wendell Marshall, and we were doing this and doing just everything all at one time. And I didn't want to do it because I didn't think I was capable, you know, and he said, "Well, I wouldn't ask you to do it if I didn't think you were capable, you know." I said, "Well, I don't know. I'm not too experienced with a big band and all that, you know." And he said, "Don't worry about anything. Just go on and come in and play." And when I walked in the studio, Gil had about 5 or 6 music stands in front of the place, the position where the drums were supposed to be. About 10 sheets of music spread out, you know, about 7 or 8 feet long on these things. I said, "Cut! dog. Listen, dude, how am I going to get through this? And Miles walked in, and he walked over. Hey, how you doing? Hey, how you? Everything all right? And he took the music. He just took all the music and and folded it up and put it on his music stand. And he told Gil, tell Arthur that Arthur play what he wants to play, just how he feels it. And that was how we did it.
So did Gil Evans give you a sense of what he wanted at all? Or were you just on your own?
Oh yes, he was a very fine director, you know.
What would he tell you?
And he liked my drumming. So when you like somebody, it's somebody's work, it's easy to work with them, you know.
So what would he tell you?
Certain accents or something he would want me to do, you know, or maybe he would like me to play softer. He was very descriptive with his hands and his body motions, mm-hmm. which I found very interesting because it took us about 2 weeks, you know, to do the album. We were in there several days, you know, maybe 4 or 5 sessions. So I was around these people every day for quite a period.
You recorded with Thelonious Monk. Pianist Thelonious Monk. Let me play something from 1959 that you recorded with him, a Thelonious Monk composition, Jackying. Drum solo. Did Monk want it to start with a drum solo?
That record has a special spot for me because everywhere I go, all over the world, Japan, Europe, any place I go, the people always say, "Oh, that solo or jacking with Thelonious Monk is so fantastic," you know. And I look at it myself. Thelonious that said to me, he says, give us 8-bar introduction, play it on the cymbals, you know? And it was something very simple and very basic and very short. And that's my most famous solo. That's incredible. Everywhere I go, people look at me like I'm something special because of that solo.
So do you have to play that solo in concerts now?
Well, this is something, what I played, it's not a solo, it's just something that I basically do generally thousands of times,
uh-huh,
you know?
Uh-huh.
So it's not some great improvisation or something of the moment, you know. But other people look at it different, you know. So it's all right with me.
Now, Monk had a reputation of being very verbally non-communicative. I mean, even when you interviewed him, I think mm-hmm. you sat with him for several hours and
yes.
got about 2 pages of transcribed
correct,
notes.
Correct, correct.
Interesting transcription, but not very verbose.
Yeah.
Was it hard to communicate with him musically?
No, Monk was a very direct person, something I liked. He's probably too direct for this planet. People have to be a little, they can't deal with Monk because he looks you right in the eye and tells you just where it is. It's very easy for him to say that you got a big head or you think you're better than somebody else. He could say that very easily. And with the tone, it could make a person really upset. But musically, Monk was, it was very difficult to play with him because he is... domineering, put it that way. He's domineering in his playing, in his, that's the word, domineering.
Did you ever have trouble finding what was suitable to play behind his rhythms, which were so angular and jagged and unlike what anybody had played before?
Yeah, I found that very difficult. That's the hardest job I ever had playing with Thelonious Monk. Very difficult because he plays the end between off tempo. It's not slow.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little bit just before slow or too slow. Or if it's fast, it's just before it gets to that point where it can really, where it can really take off. Whereas it requires a lot more concentration. And at the time I was working with him, he was a stickler for timing. And he said to me one time, he says, look, I don't care what you play. I don't care how loud you play, or you know, but make it fit, which is what improvised music is supposed to be about.
So did your drumming change as a result of playing with Monk?
He thought so.
How did he think it changed?
He thought I wasn't nothing till I played with him. That's what he used to tell me. I couldn't play nothing till I played with him.
Was he more talkative in life than he was when you were interviewing him?
Oh, he was a beautiful man, lovely man, lovely man. Very, very humorous, very, very direct, and very kind. Yes. Mm-hmm. I love Thelonious.
Now, your band, Taylor's Whalers.
Taylor's Whalers, yes.
Has musicians who are considerably younger than you are.
Yes. I'm older than their fathers.
Are you?
Yeah.
Yeah, so how does it feel for you to be, like, the father figure in the band as well as the drummer?
Yeah, it's not like I'm a father figure because I have a tremendous amount of energy and I'm getting better all the time.
Sounds like you don't want to be a father figure.
No, I'm a father figure. No. We all have, we're all equal level. We all have our end to hold up. And I'm going to do the job. But I have a tremendous amount of energy. They get tired before I do. It's funny. Yeah, I talk to the people, have a drink with the people, talk to the women, talk to the guys, get the money, collect the money, sign the contract, pay them, get the plane tickets, get on the bus, go over there, play all night, sweat completely like I've come out of a rainstorm, and then they're tired before me. I like it. It's nice.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure.
Arthur Taylor's book of interviews with jazz musicians, Notes and Tones, has just been published in a new edition by DeCapo Press.